This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.
Coaxial.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Coaxial with me, Christian Corley, and Gareth Cavanagh. As ever, joins me, and our special guest is James McLean. Hello, James.
Hello.
Hello. We're talking about VHS. Now, this was prompted by an amazing tweet that was shared. Hello, eBay. An amazing tweet that was shared, which featured a bunch of VHS cassettes highlighting the amazing package design that went into blank VHS boxes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some fantastic sort of grindhouse art. It's very much like the Great Spectrum games, where they didn't actually know what the game was, and a lot of these guys didn't know what the film was, had a collection of stills, and were just told to come up with something that sold the film brilliantly. It's an era that I love. I think we should rewind a bit here, literally rewind, and just think back to how important VHS is. I think it's the most important revolutionary home medium in the history of entertainment, up until only superseded by the television itself.
Now, that's an interesting statement.
Well, it gave us the power to decide what we were watching and when. It let us discover vast back catalogues. You know, we didn't have to wait for someone in the BBC to go, I know, let's show this film that hasn't been on for ages. We didn't have to wade through hours of stuff on BBC Two. We literally would rent we'd rent that film and we'd watch it in the comfort of our own home. And in the case of us young video bairns from Generation One, you know, I'm not at all thinking of the Battlestar Galactica movie in 1980. Watched it maybe 2 dozen times during that 3-day rental.
Of course, the 3-day rental. The video rental store.
Yeah, the 3-day rental. That was how it used to be.
We had Blockbuster in the UK, didn't we? Which I think was a US company originally. I think they spread over here, but before we had those, it was all lots of little privately owned things or shelves in the newsagent where you rented videos, wasn't it?
What was your video shop then?
Oh, we had several. They always seemed to... Well, we had an electronic store called McKenna and Brown in Redcar. And there's one in Middlesbrough and another one in Stockton. So it was like a local electronics retailer chain. And wherever there was one of those, there would be two or three little video rental places nearby. So, like, people going in and spending £300 on a video or renting it, a video recorder player. And then these businesses obviously hope that they would then pop in to rent E.T. or whatever. So, I can't remember what they were called, but eventually those businesses were shut down because they would insist on, like, membership and a deposit that was non-returnable and some proof of identification for who you were. And this is obviously in the early mid 1980s, before like digital storage or anything like that. So you'd have to provide all these things and come back like 3 days later to to get your membership card, and then you'd rent something for like £5 for 3 days or whatever. Obviously the prices came down later on, but I think these businesses folded because of that nonsense, and eventually you got like your Blockbuster chain would spread across the UK, or you just go to your newsagents and rent it, and they knew who you were.
We were lucky in London though. We had 4 or 5 really good video shops, you know, and those shops were my Library of Alexandria. You know, I used to go in and gaze at all these video boxes and think, I want to watch that. I want to watch that. That looks brilliant. I want to watch that. And you just wanted to watch everything in that shop. You know, it just takes me back. I never liked Blockbuster though. Blockbuster felt impersonal. It always felt like a race against the clock to get it back, or they'd fine you. They'd write you. And all that stuff. Whereas, you know, the little video shops, you know, they were precious and glorious. But I stand by, they are the single most important democratization. You know, I don't know how many cinemas you guys had in your towns growing up. I mean, James, you lived in cities, didn't you? We had one by the time we came around to the sort of late 80s, mid 80s, which meant that if you had a big summer film like Ghostbusters, that was on the cinema for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
That meant you could only see about 30 films a year on release, more or less. You know, less if there were a couple of big, because we got Gremlins after the Americans, so we got Gremlins in about sort of October. So Gremlins was another 6 week run in the cinema. So I reckon we only got to see about 25 films a year, and you were kind of then down to the tastes of whoever was running the cinema. But now in the video shop, you started with about 500 films that you could choose from, and it was added to every week. Glorious. Glorious.
James, what was your first video experience?
I remember having a time like Gareth, where it must have been sort of mid to early 80s after Flash Gordon came out. And I remember as a young, very young child, when Flash Gordon actually released, having the sticker album and the LP, which is where I'd perhaps contest Gareth and say the record player was just as important in different ways for bringing media into the living room. But
that was a very special album, that. Yeah.
So I had that album and I listened to it a lot. So when finally, I remember going to Bramshill, where my grandfather and grandmother lived, and they had a video store near them. And because we went over the weekend, over those 3 days, I had the Flash Gordon VHS and I did what Gareth did. And you just watched it repetitively. I mean, one, because it opened up visuals and an experience that I had almost conjured in my head from sticker albums, storybooks, and the record, because the record of Flash Gordon by Queen was narratively linked.
Yeah.
So you could almost listen to it as a story. And so it was just fascinating. I remember that being one of my key video rentals.
My God, I'd forgotten there was a Flash Gordon sticker album until then.
Yeah, I
completed that. I've still got it, but all the drummers dropped off half the stickers, so it's now incomplete again.
Well, I had three things against me with that. The first was that we didn't have much money at the time. So I remember my mother would go, at lunchtime, she'd go down to the store schools and grab, a pack. Yeah. The second thing is it wasn't very popular generally, because Flash Gordon
very quickly. Yeah.
And third, I had no friends, so there was absolutely no one to actually share with, even if I wanted to. So I never completed it. But it was that thing, and I think again, what the videos brought, the video rental, was this sort of intense introduction into the actual texts, which you adored, which you couldn't get to see any else because you were young. Unless you'd gone to see it in the cinema, you wouldn't be able to see it. It wouldn't be on TV. There would be no, as we have now, no YouTubes, there'd be no trailers to see. I used to watch Top of the Pops waiting for the Queen video just to see clips from the...
Do you know, now you say that, I don't think I actually saw Flash Gordon on the cinema. I think I listened to the album. I definitely had the sticker album, because that was almost like an article of faith. But I don't think I saw it till it came out on video either.
I didn't have the sticker album, but I don't think, but I definitely had stickers. I didn't have Panini stickers, but I just don't think I had the album. But I only ever saw it on video.
But that video thing was that engagement with stuff which was already out in a sort of peripheral nature. And suddenly the video store gave me this, because like you said, the cinema, you only had a very small opportunity to see it. And then it depended on your family, whether they'd take you, depending on how old you were.
Yeah.
So the video library for kids was this, like, as you say, this treasure trove of things you'd heard of, or maybe seen in a couple of magazines, or as you say, got a sticker album of, which suddenly you could sort of get out and then you could intensely watch it. I agree. I by the Blockbuster video, I was no longer doing that, I think, because I was just buying VHS videos. But so to me, it was either that very early period where you had that sort of independent level, like you were saying, of these sort of small little stores, which are just chock a block with VHS videos and the embarrassing Beta video section at the back. Or you then got to the sort of when the petroleum station started to get in on the act, and they would do their sort of glass wall where you wouldn't be able, it wasn't as good because you couldn't pull them out. They would be behind, they'd just be like the front cards behind glass.
Oh, that's right,
and a light to tell you whether they were in or not. And then you'd have to go to the counter with the number, which was still kind of interesting because it was a less of a collection. So you'd go in with less of an idea of what you'd be able to get out. So it was a little more random or less special, but that in a sense made it what you did get out possibly more special or worse. I remember getting some terrible films out there. The James Belushi one. Is it? Was it Mr. Miracle, Dr. Miracle? Come on, Gareth, you must know it.
Oh, lost me here. That must have been pretty bad.
It was one of those. It was one of those films which, let's have a quick look. Film, and it was called Mr. Destiny, and it was just a sort of one of those role reversal films, sort of like The Vice Versa, but between trading places between rich and poor. Very simple knockoff. James Belushi, you can get the level of quality, but it was just kind of special. It was just kind of enjoyable. Had it for 3 days, never saw it again. And that's what the video store gave you, as you said. It was that intense viewing of something, possibly, that you enjoyed. If you got something you enjoyed from it, you could watch it over and over again, and then it'd be gone again. It was oddly sort of owned and disposed.
It was. And you know what? I think a lot of films were made by when they were released, because there were certain times. I remember the summer, there seemed to be no new films came out in the summer or video of any note. It always seemed to be spring and autumn. And yeah, occasionally something would slip out in the summer. Like I remember Big Trouble in Little China came out in summer 87. And because there was literally nothing out genre, like either side for months, that flew off the shelves and became a huge hit. I think solely because it came out when we were all hungry for content and there was nothing there.
Hmm.
Well, I tell you what else. This I've been thinking about this a lot, bizarrely, in the last 2 weeks, because I'm involved in a brilliant project in Liverpool at the moment called Video Odyssey. I'm supplying arcade machines for this wonderful, crazy, beautiful guy is building a new video store in Toxteth. And he's having all the big box rentals. He's going to run a proper video shop with membership. And he's going to let people rent VCRs. And he's having a screening suite and a secret arcade in the back. It's immense. So I've been looking at those big box rentals, because he's amassed hundreds and hundreds of them. And looking at weird films like Critical Condition, a terrible-looking comedy with Bob Hoskins from 1988, which I'm sure I would have watched. And I can't remember a thing about it. But the iconography of everything about it is beautiful. I still remember my membership number at North Wales Video, K43. No, F193, because F meant free. That meant the old man was tight. If you paid the £10 a year membership, you got first dibs on putting your little sticker on the video. You know, when you wanted to, like, reserve First Blood or something, you'd have, like, your sticker on it. And I was K43 in Cavern Records. Oh, glorious. Glorious.
I mean, I think it's interesting. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I don't have any memory of details like that at all, I'm afraid.
But I was video obsessive, mate. You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, fair enough. But that's what I suppose if you're going there, if you're going enough, do you sort of like go in and utter the magic code word of your membership and then, See, I'd just leave that to my parents, because I'm younger than you. So,
yes, you are a youth. Sorry, James, you were saying. Anyway,
yes,
you
James.
Were about to... I was going to say, I mean, I just remember one of the films I saw, and it was about 86 or so, and it was, again, it was The Independent. It was before it went to the Q8 sort of things and the other garages. It was Orin, I think it was The Legend of Orin, Star Chaser.
Oh yeah,
that again, something that was one of those sort of titles which was never big at the time. It had a DVD release in the States. I don't think it ever had one in the UK. A big sort of rotoscoped knockoff of Star Wars build, you know, the best 3D movie. I remember again watching that and being I just remember, as you were saying, it was when you said the intensity of those periods. Mm-hmm. I mean, not always. Obviously, it was a film which was all right. Maybe when you got older, you'd watch it once. But as a kid, getting films in, and you just could do that opportunity to rewatch. You had it with VHS, because obviously to watch it, you had to have a VHS player. And I remember having the first VHS cassette I got for that was 60 minutes long. And that I recorded an episode of Star Trek on there, which was The Naked Time, and watched that over and over and over again. So, I mean, there's also that factor of VHS.
Home Kathleen. Is that the I'll Take You Home, Kathleen one?
Naked Time. No, I don't think it's the one where they get infected by the...
The drunken Irishman in the the engine room.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Cool.
Who appears, I think.
You've watched that 8,000 times.
So, yeah, again, it's that rewatchability, which you just didn't have before that.
Well, that was the revolution, I think. And it was the ability. And I think it is solely because of that that we became obsessive fans of certain things. You know, Star Wars, I remember recording that off the TV in 1982, summer 82, yeah, October 82 when it came out. I must have watched that hundreds of times. I remember I could recount the entire Greedo scene word for word. In fact, I could probably have recounted the whole film if I'd sat down and thought hard enough about it. That was
if you'd ever got past the Greedo scene.
If I'd ever got that. That was my party piece in the playground. I would always play Greedo, naturally.
But it's, again, how that all links in as a multimedia thing, because I was looking at the other day, because on a slightly different topic, me and my sister were talking about the Friday night lineups on Channel 4 in the 80s and how you'd start with Cheers, there'd be a break, and then it'd die, or the Cosby Show. No, Cosby Show, break, and then Roseanne, or who's, you know, there were certain lineups, but they
Golden
we
Girls.
Were trying to remember it. I was looking at old TV times, and as I was looking at old TV times on the internet and looking in 87 and seeing the Christmas editions, because those are the ones they tend to have online, and you can see those films that you'd, and I could hear myself in my head thinking, oh great, look, I can see on the 27th of December, you know, it's one of those films that doesn't quite make the hit of being on the holiday, but just slightly after, which sometimes you get some real treasure troves, would be The Black Hole. I'll be recording that. And then
I'll definitely be recording that. Yeah.
You know, Flash Gordon or a James Bond movie. And it was all about how many videotapes you had to be able to cover all these things you wanted to record.
The interesting thing, you know, watching them now is, you know, stuff that you've recorded off the TV specifically. Although I suppose there's, in terms of rentals, you have the trailers of interest, because old trailers are always different to new trailers. Even like,
still contextualizes.
Yeah, it does. But often the video trailers, the trailers you've seen on the video, they weren't quite the same as one you see in the cinema. But I'm digressing. The adverts that you've recorded when you've recorded something on ITV and you haven't been around to hit pause to get that little quick cut of the closing frame to the opening frame, that little in between as you restart it. When you've left it.
Is it 10 right in the middle?
Say that again?
Use at 10 would come straight.
Of course, News at 10, so you'd cast a little bit of Sir Alistair Stewart or whatever. Burnett.
It's just bonkers to think about it now.
But yeah, if you left the adverts in, then you've got all these crazy adverts. They're absolutely balmy. And like, we've talked about adverts before, haven't we, Gareth? And like, you've like shared them on Facebook or whatever. Right. And there's some amazing adverts in the past, and you watch them now on these old videotapes, whether your own or you've bought them from a car boot or whatever. And some of them are absolutely absurd. Some of them, like there was one that someone shared a few days ago on Twitter that was like the most 90. It was described as the most 1980s advert, and it was absolutely visually horrendous. And it had all sort of weird sort of video tricks and
nice
backgrounds and stuff going on in it. And then you'd have weird things like the bloke with his dog smoking. He's either smoking in a pub or he's buying a John Smith's in a pub. I can't remember. And these very sort of grainy, grimy adverts that attempting to recreate life as it was then.
Oh, I'm a Green or Whitley Land man myself.
Is that
Do
a
you
bit?
Remember I wish I was in Green or Whitley Land?
No, I don't know. What's that one?
Oh, I'll post you. It's brilliant.
Okay.
it was. They were always the same thing. Where they had like there were three. I remember there was one with a guy in the Foreign Legion, in a French Foreign Legion fort, and everyone's dead, and it's just him, and there's bullets flying around.
Oh.
And he starts, you know, I wish I was in Green or Whitley Land, and it sort of zips back to a nice traditional pub, you know, and then it all ends with them singing. But most of all, Green or Whitley. There's one there. There's one in the Chain Gang. Which is good. And then there's one quite bizarrely where they're in heaven and he's in the afterlife sitting around the cloud, you know, with his harp and that, and actually he'd rather be back in the pub. Because obviously they don't have Greedle Whitley in heaven.
Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't?
I know. But well, you're right. It's a window into our past, and it contextualizes, you know, all of the stuff that we used to watch.
Well, there is something else, though.
I can still remember where the advert breaks came in a film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Star Wars, I can still kind of remember where the advert breaks are. Because I watched that Star Wars with the adverts thousands of times. So I know.
Do you know what? Watching Star Wars and having it on video, just something that always used to disturb me more than anything else, is that when C-3PO is being attacked by the Sand People, and there's that upwards wipe as they lift him away, it looks as though his legs have been swept off him.
Oh, yes.
And that used to give me nightmares, just because I had it on video, so I could watch it all the time. And I just watched that bit over and over again. My sister did a similar thing. We would get up early on a Saturday morning to watch a video, and we only had two videos. One of them was Star Wars, and one of them was Superman 2.
Nice.
And Justine was obsessed by the bit when Lois throws herself into the river.
Oh, yeah.
And shouts, "Bye bye, baby." And what she'd do, she'd watch it, and she'd rewind it 30 seconds, 5 seconds, whatever, watch it again, and just do it repeatedly for like 20, 25 minutes on the old, you know, the old wired remote control.
Nice.
So she did it over and over again. And eventually you get a mark on the video cassette, don't you?
Feel the peril. Yeah, you would wear it out. That's true. Yeah. That is true.
And that you know, that mark was still there like 15 years later. We could watch Superman 2 and watch it. And then, that's Justine. That rewind it and playing it again.
Nice. Moonraker. I'll tell you where the break for news at 10 was in Moonraker. It was where Chang gets thrown out the window and lands in the grand piano, and he goes, "Play it again, Sam." And then it was like, "Moonraker continues after the news." Glorious.
Moonraker was the first James Bond movie I watched.
Oh, me too. I'm that sad. I can even tell you where the break for the intermission in Moonraker was in the Palladium in Llandudno in 1979. And that is where he gets out the gondola and sneaks into Holly Goodhead's room. Mm-hmm. And that was where the intermission came, and we could purchase a Kiora or a Lion's Mane orange lolly. Mm.
Tasty.
Very tasty.
Now, there is a couple of other things to do with the age of video that we've kind of ignored so far. One of them is the heinous crime of video piracy.
Oh, my first pirated video that I personally pirated was Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge.
Right, and when you say personally pirated, don't you mean you produced a pirate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wow. We had a second video, and it was a proper old piano key clunky thing, but I found they were absolutely perfect for getting around the copy protection, the Macrovision, because this thing was so old, it seemed to filter out the protection system. So, I had a fantastic library. I also used to photocopy the sleeves for that extra authenticity.
Would I be right in thinking that you maybe made a few bob out of this?
I might have done a couple of copies for pals who were keen on things. Yes, it's possible. We had a couple of our video shops also completely ignored the 18 certificate thing, so we were able to go in and rent wherever we wanted with impunity.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned that because you were talking about cinemas, hometown cinemas. Well, we had a hometown cinema, which is still open now, although it isn't open now. It closed about a month ago because it's falling apart.
Is it Wetherspoons?
No, it's not Wetherspoons. Not yet. It's the end of there used to be two piers in my town. One of them closed. I don't know when they both closed. But this particular pier, it was closed, and the pavilion end of it was converted into a theatre. At first, it is culturally significant because it is where the great Larry Grayson first uttered the phrase "shut that door."
Nice.
When a storm blew the stage door open, and
that's good knowledge.
Yeah,
there should be a blue plaque for that.
There should. There might be, but they might have to hover it in midair because it's falling apart due to the sea at the moment. And later it became a cinema, and you could go into the cinema at age, 1986? 10 and a half, and watch Aliens.
Nice. Nice. Well, I found you had to pick your member of staff in London, though.
Right.
I worked out that their quietest night of the week was Tuesday. So a Tuesday 7:30 showing would only have the dithery old dear called Lucy on, who looked like a thousand and didn't care and would just nod you in and then pop out and sell the ice creams at half time because all the other staff were off. And it was, I put my biggest ski jacket on and and not shave. And when I was, and this was 14, you know, but I had the little tash. And,
yeah, a bit of charcoal on your hands from art class and just rub them on your cheeks a bit.
Oh, no, there's no need for that. You know, I was like, well, they're wolf kids. And I used to, I was great. So I had a brilliant run of Nightmare on Elm Street 3. That was my first 18 that I went to see. Wasn't lucky enough to see Alien, you lucky blighters. And then I saw Predator. And then there was like The Running Man. And it was just a great run of great films.
Yeah.
But do you know the thing we haven't really talked about? And I bet James would have got this, is the power of the posters and the artwork that would festoon these video shops.
Oh, of course.
And would just draw you in to the most average of films. Canon in particular seemed to know how this worked. It would suck you into a dreadful film on the promise of something very good indeed.
But at the same time, and I was having a conversation about this on a similar topic with video games, and again, the embellishments of covers over the content was that you did tend to know that this was a ruse, that you knew that what would be in there would not live up to the cover. You knew Hawk the Slayer would never be quite as epical as the cover would suggest. And so you go in sort of vaguely aware that this would not be what you, it was a, because it was a point where effects could not mirror the illustration that would be shown on the cover. Be that superhero, fantasy, science fiction. So you'd go in half aware. So it was almost like it was like a taster, but it was a taster that you knew. It'd be a question of how close it was, not whether it could be the same. Unlike now, where if you see a DVD for, I don't know, even big name things, the effects can be fairly good, or even sci-fi. Let's face it, even sci-fi stuff can be fairly effective. The channel. But then you never really had that. Even the big stuff would still be issues with. So you kind of knew that you appreciated the art for what it was suggesting, not for what you thought would be inside the box. In the same way you had that with video games, because video games was even a bigger disconnect from that immediacy, from what you'd see on the cover to what you'd get. As we said before, the Mastertronic range for the Spectrum.
Mm.
Heinous crimes between... It's
only paying $1.99 though, or exactly. $2.99 for a very special one.
But it was a world where you knew that you knew that what was on the cover could not be translated within the medium. So you went in with a different expectation to, I think, what you'd have now, where the medium can to some degree match what's given on the cover. If that makes sense. I think that in a sense is great now. In a sense, at the time, it made it more interesting because you were really judging that gap between what you were being sold to what you were actually getting and how close that gap was. Never that gap would not exist, but how far that gap would be between those two points. And I'm trying to think of examples of why. I mean, I even think of Flash Gordon, which had a fantastic cover, if you remember the one with the very muscly Sam J. Jones. So looking into the camera with his arm out. Well, there's several covers, to be fair.
It's like the British Quad, isn't it? The British Quad, I think, it's a very green poster from memory.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And that, I mean, again, the film was still very beautiful and still quite ethereal and lots of great stuff in it. But did that, so its immediacy to that cover wasn't that far removed, to be fair to it. It wasn't still there because Sam J. Jones is not as ripped as he is on that front image to start with. His legs are not as long as that, but it was pretty close. But then you'd get other ones which would never be able to, within a million years, be as close as the cover would suggest to what you'd get. And that sort of method was done on most films of most genres as well. You think of the Cannonball Run, and the sort of covers from that would be less about the comedy. It would be all about the amount of different people in it, the cars all shooting towards you. It would all be about something which the film, while it was about, would perhaps be in a different tone to some degree to what the cover might give you. But again, that was still pretty close to what the cover. But obviously, the cheaper you got, the further the distance between that immediacy to the cover was.
Yes, yes. Well, a lost age. I tell you what, we had a good chat before we came on air about Space 1999. Did you ever rent the Space 1999 compilation movies that they did?
I didn't. I know of them, but I never saw. I did the Battlestar Galacticas.
Oh, they were great.
Oh, yeah. Same here. I never knew about the Space 1999 on video. I've only briefly seen it on TV.
Ennio Morricone scores. They're quite weird.
Oh, so they got a different score because it's Destination. Is it Destination Moonbase Alpha or something? Yeah. It's called Destination Alpha.
And then there's another one, which I think is War Games. They've got Ennio Morricone scores. They're completely rescored. They're pretty cool. I remember I didn't realise this. Andrew Cartmell was raving about it a few years ago, going, "Well, you know, it's a completely different watching experience, and this Morricone score just gives the entire thing a lift." And could you imagine? can you imagine something from Doctor Who, 1976, being rescored with Ennio Morricone music?
But why did they do that?
I'm guessing it's Serlu grade wanted product for this brand new mass medium. They needed product for the first video range. So I remember the early video shops didn't have much in them. And so wily old foxes like Serlu grade and ITC suddenly went, "Oh, hang on, we've got stuff. What have we got? Something for the kiddos, Space 1999. Well, we can edit it together into, you know, feature-length movies. Not sure about the pimp disco soundtrack. What have we got? Well, Morricone's not doing anything.
Of course,
anything
it makes sense, doesn't it, in the 80s, doesn't it? Yeah, of course, yeah.
I mean, these are from about 1980s. So they're very early. I mean, they just are scrambling for product.
Otherwise, it looks 10 years old immediately, doesn't it? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But they're interesting. They're interesting. And the Galactica ones are fantastic. The movie isn't so much different, but Mission Galactica, the Pegasus one, where they then tack on the fire in the Galactica at the end.
Yeah.
Works brilliantly.
Yeah, that's the one I remember. Mm. Destination Moonbase Alpha, 1978. I'm just wondering, because, I mean, it was the era where, because the...
Cinema release as well.
I was going to say, because obviously Galactica got the cinema release, as did Rogers, but they are American... Base. Did Destination Alpha, Destination Moonbase Alpha, did that get a cinematic release?
I think it got a European cinematic release for sure.
Did Battlestar Galactica get a UK release in cinema?
Yeah, it did.
I thought I saw it.
If you look in the early Doctor Who weeklies, there's adverts for it in there.
Yeah, and my dad told me to see the pictures to see it.
I was so jealous. No, we didn't get it. In Llandud, though, the Swines, or even Colwyn Bay. Oh.
Apparently, the only territory.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to talk about it. The only territory to have had a cinema release of Destination Moonbase Alpha was Denmark, around 1979 or 1980. But I think you're right. I think there's this knock-on effect from Star Wars, which sort of pushed towards these cinematic releases of Battlestar Galactica and of Buck Rogers, I think, followed. Which maybe Space 1999 was trying to capitalize on and didn't market. Because, I mean, anything of Gerry Anderson's was always trying to be sold to the States, so...
Yeah. I think Galactica I'd love to have seen on the cinema, and I bet that would have worked really well. And certainly Mission Galactica, I remember having a release, because, again, I saw the adverts, enviously read the adverts in Doctor Who Weekly. Space 1999... Not so sure that's going to cut it in the cinema.
No. I mean, the Galactica ones were good. I mean, because the first Galactica pilot was quite as with all Gerry Larson pilots, was quite dark.
Huge budget as well.
Has huge budgets, so quite dark, quite significant ideas playing into them before they sort of move into a sort of more standardized television format. So that would be a really good one. And because it was a three-part story, it in itself needs to be truncated to movie length rather than extended.
It'll cut to 2 hours very easily,
which they did. And but with the second one, which was, I think it was called Mission Galactica,
it was, yeah, the Cylon Attack.
Cylon Attack, yes, colon colon, the Silent Attack, that, as you say, obviously had to be extended and had to take the two-parter of the Pegasus story and then add the... it wasn't called Inferno, I can't remember what it was called, but yeah, the one where the Galactica's on fire.
And it's a brilliant. It works.
And it works, yeah.
It really works.
And it flows well as well, strangely. I mean, I remember watching that Mission Galactica before I saw the series and obviously didn't realise.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah, they were interesting things, which, again, like you say, were there for the video market more than anything else. But then, I hate to say it, but then you can also go to other things, which we've talked about before, Blake 7, with its original VHS rental releases, where I think the beginning box set was a truncation of the first four episodes into about 2 hours.
The BBC was characteristically slow. You know, when you think back to, you know, when you think back to that first release of Revenge of the Cybermen.
Yes.
You know, it is, and I really wanted it. You know, there was one place in Llandudno that had it. It's this crappy little news agent. My mum dug her heels and said, "No, we're not joining yet another video shop. We're already in five." I was like, but, you know, but I must have it. You know, and then in the end, it disappeared. You know, it probably got nicked. But they were slow. They were slow. They were slow to capitalize and, you know, a bit sniffy about video, I think. Didn't really, in that typical BBC way, it was almost like, we can't have the people deciding what they want to watch and when. Where will this end? No. Leave it to the professional schedulers. They know what they're doing.
And but they, even on those releases, you have, again, that whole cinematic thing where we're used to it now, if we're slightly old, but that was when they took off the episodes and made into one omnibus.
It was the right thing to do, really. You know, it was just the done thing, wasn't it? I mean, it's insane to think that you would sit down and watch something in one go where you've got credits every 25 minutes. It's the correct thing to do from an archive perspective. But in the early 80s, when you're just trying to sell this as... You know, you're just trying to get content on that shelf and you want people to rent it alongside something else, you know, so dad can have First Blood and Jaws and something for the kiddos. Oh, well, this week they'll have Doctor Who and maybe a set of Superman cartoons.
But I think that's quite fascinating because the between it being sort of like an event and an archival experience, that distance was very short because I remember watching... When they brought those Blake 7s out on budget from being rentals in the 80s, so the end of the 80s, they brought them out on budget for, it might have been the beginning of the 90s, I think it was the end of the 80s.
Early 90s, I think. Was it to a tape?
No, it was before that. They released four, and three of them were the ones which were on rental, which were the beginning, Duel and Aurak, which the first one could truncated four into 2 hours, the other two could truncated three, and they also released Aftermath, which was the beginning of series three, as well, in the same sort of format, especially for budget, and they were for $9.99. And by that, and that was just before, like you say, they went and then started doing the two per episode release about a year or so later. But what was interesting with those was it was at a point where when I was watching them, I remembered it from being as a kid. So I was looking for the archival experience within a space of 9 years. I was not looking for event, I was looking for archive, and I wanted those beginning sequences because that was part of my experience. So even within that short period, event had gone and archive had occurred, and we were looking, and the same with Doctor Who. When people got Doctor Who, even on, I think, the rental, they were trying to engage into the memories because they couldn't get it any other way, and it wasn't on television either. So you were looking for those intro sequences because they were part of your watching. That was part of the flow of watching Doctor Who that you were trying to replicate in watching it. So even in the early few years, you still are.
It only work if you leave a gap, strangely. I find if I sit down and go watch all on Doctor Who DVD, the credits do get in the way. I lose concentration. And it's interesting. You know, they've even built that in with the Twitch kids, where you get the brilliant trailers in between them. You know, I mean, they've become art in themselves, you know.
Yes.
The second Doctor one, yeah. I want to help you! You know, and then everyone starts tweeting all that, or London 1965.
Yeah,
you know, it's... So there is a concession to it, even there, that we need... a little break and just a little reminder, yeah, this is great.
Okay, let's switch things around a bit. Okay. Worst and best VHS experiences. Ooh. I'll start you off, okay?
Okay.
So my worst VHS experience is the pirate copy of E.T., which was like 16th generation when we saw it.
And oh, wow.
To this nice. Day, I've never been able to put up with E.T. I spent, 90 minutes watching it in 1980, whatever, three, squinting up as close to the telly as I could get to work out what was going on. And I've never cared for it much ever since, to be honest with you. So that's my worst VHS experience. My best VHS experience is the special edition of GoldenEye, which I've still got, which came with the Tina Turner CD single. Hey? Eh?
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Tina Turner CD single, a edition of the James Bond fan club magazine about GoldenEye, and a Parker pen, like the one in the film, but obviously it doesn't explode.
Nice.
I've That's still got that nice. Little box. It's nice. It's a limited edition of 25,000. So
nice. Nice.
Okay, so what about you, James?
Worst. I can think of my most disappointing. I remember seeing Flight of the Navigator on VHS, and again, even though the cinema had the same, the cover made it seem far more adventurous than it actually was, where you spend like the first act in a bit before you even get to the saucer. In fact, it only feels like the final act when he's sort of flying around with it. And it felt like it wasn't the movie I was expecting. So the cover sort of threw me quite significantly. That's probably the one that I remember worst. The best, the two I'd spring to, the Orin Legend of the Star Chaser, I remember taking that back from the shops and feeling sad. Sorry, taking it back to the rental and feeling sad to give that back. There was something about it which maybe at that time in my life, for whatever reason, just chimed. And I just wanted to go back into that world. Very weird. Or maybe the VHS of The Usual Suspects, because it was the first VHS I saw to ever have a commentary. And that was on a second VHS. Which
wow,
was
really?
So that was the first commentary I ever saw, and it was on wow. Usual Suspects, and it was, as I say, second VHS you had to put in and rewatch the film with the commentary on that tape, which I thought was pretty at the time. It was pretty cool. It was a good commentary too.
Nice. Worst experience, I think, probably the most irritating ones. I remember nagging my old man for weeks in the early 80s to rent out Star Trek, the motion picture. And we finally got it, and it had a line all the way through it throughout the entire middle of the film. So it had been damaged. And that, to this day, it still irritates. We should have got our £2 back. And the best experience, and I remember, for me, it's really got to be the Alien Special Edition VHS with those extra scenes in, just because that, for me, is the dawn of the next book in our evolution, which is DVD, and the sense that actually studios and directors can have a second go at this. They're not constrained by what we saw on the cinema, because you have to completely replicate what was on the cinema, because otherwise you're cheating the audience. No, it was a sense that actually we can have a long form story, and we can, and the excitement of, because when I first saw it trailed on Barry Norman, and they just showed about 3 seconds of the Sentry robot guns. That was just the most exciting thing I could imagine. And it lived up to it when I got it, actually. Even though a couple of the cuts are a bit shonky, I think the special edition of Aliens is probably... that's a watershed.
I've never watched that. I know most of what happens because I've read the novelization about 3 days after I watched the film. I bought it. I've never watched the special edition for some reason.
Well, actually, now I'm eulogising about it. I actually would say I prefer the theatrical cut now,
right?
Because it's tighter and
tighter. Yeah, yeah. It's usually the way, isn't it?
What you don't need is all the sort of prelude on Hadley's Hope, where it's all the families and go and find the derelict. You don't need any of that. That just gets in the way. But I do like the sentry guns is great. So.
I was listening to the original Star Wars audio version the other day, and I was immediately put in mind of the Aliens novelization, how you've got all this stuff at the beginning, which obviously isn't in the film, which they've added into the audio adaptation. And I'm pretty sure I'd heard it before, but I did find it bloody dull going. It doesn't need to be three episodes long, I don't think, that portion of the story. Might be two, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, you don't need it. It gets in the way of of the film. I mean, and interestingly, with the director's cut, they didn't put everything back in either. So there's a missing scene where Ripley bumps into Burke when she's on her way down to rescue Newt.
Yes.
And they have a conversation. She leaves him a grenade. And you can still see bits of that in there, because there's a weird bit where the sort of, her heart's thumping and she sort of, it's a tight shot. She comes around a corner and then suddenly she's off down a corridor and it's like it never happened. So I wonder if that material was just lost, or if just even Cameron just decided, no, I don't want that.
I suppose it just distracts from the pacing. I imagine that's why it was taken out, because it stops the movement, doesn't it? And so it says, oh, remember this guy? And at that point, you're wanting your audience to be thinking, no, we want them to be thinking about Newt.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the reason. Because I suppose in the end, you don't really need to know what happens to him. I suppose it's that sort of 1980s... Yeah, you need to sort of perhaps punish him a little more. And maybe that's why it was originally included in there, but I don't know.
It'll escape eventually. Yeah, that's true. And actually, yeah, in the same way that I don't think finding Dallas... It's the same scene as Ripley finding Dallas in Alien, cocooned, when she's on her way out to the shuttle, I think.
Yeah.
And that gets in the way as well. I mean, it's interesting, but it completely gets in the way. So I think we've done this podcast before, haven't we, where we say director's cuts are very often not as good as the original. Apologies, yes.
Okay,
well, you can find that one about 3 years ago.
Can anyone remember what the last VHS they bought was?
Ooh.
I'm guessing Gareth is quite recent.
Yeah, well, yes, I have bought a few. And you know, there's a problem with mould on VHS tapes.
Is there?
Yeah, if they're badly stored, if they've been stored in damp garages or anything remotely damp, they get this horrible white mould and fungus on them. So a lot of tapes are going.
Oh, dear. I better check mine.
Yeah, get them baked. Probably it would have been, because I stayed with Doctor Who to the end of the VHS range, so I'm imagining.
Yeah.
And that happened in about, what, 2004, something like that? Maybe 2005? It's quite late.
Yeah.
It really was the scrapings by the end. And I'm pretty sure I bought them all, the Swines, and then proceeded to buy them all again on DVD. And now I'll be buying them all again on Blu-ray. And presumably we'll just think into a crystal in 20 years' time and it'll all be there. So,
To think it and it'll be there.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That should be how we get the missing episodes back. We'll link Ian Levine into the crystal matrix and suck all his memories out, and then they'll be there for us to enjoy.
Yeah, unfortunately, it'll all be new Northern Soul soundtracks, though.
Well, I'm sure the Twitch kids will love that. You know, it'll bring it alive.
2003 was The Reign of Terror and the Faceless Ones, episodes 1 and 3, and Web of Fear, episode 1. That's listed as the last one.
That's probably about it.
24th of November 2003, so it's a anniversary release as well.
Nice. Yeah, that's right. I have a little badge in it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what my last one was. I have a feeling it was a Reeves and Mortimer VHS. But I'm not sure why I think that. No, it wasn't. No, my last VHS was in 2003, but it wasn't one of those. It was a Transformers.
Nah.
Transformers nice. Armada. It came in a double cassette box, but it only had one cassette in it, and it had a Transformer in it.
Oh, well, you see, that is a collectible. And you know, that's coming back. Did you see that HMV this week announced that they're doing a limited range of VHS releases?
No, I didn't. I was actually at the Metro Centre at the weekend, and I went in HMV to have a look at their vast collection of vinyl. I couldn't believe it. It was like I'd gone back in time. Last time I went into a shop and looked at vinyl, I was in there for like 5 minutes. I was looking through all this vinyl for 20 minutes thinking, I need to buy a new record player. Because I was looking at stuff that I own. You know, only now it's like it's heavier.
Vinyl is like the artifact, and they're trying to do the same with VHS. They're dipping their toes into water with VHS. So like they've done like an issue of The Thing. So you get like the video box, a tape, but you also get the, I think the DVDs or Blu-ray with it as
you
well.
You get the option to digitally download an album, don't you? So
yeah, I think there's probably a digital download, and they've got like cool little custom Topps collector cards and things like that in there. So they're definitely going straight for the serious collector, which is the right thing to do, I guess.
Yeah. Do you think there's room for that? I mean, there's obviously an argument of quality with records, which is what they play on.
I think this is more to do with the artifact. And some of those artifacts are beautiful. You know, I still get a thrill when I see the oversized Warner Brothers soft boxes, you know, that you used to get for like Mad Max and Mad Max 2 and Red Dawn. And they still have a power, you know. There's even a sort of PVC smell to them. So yeah, I could imagine it being a small but lucrative little sub scene in the same way that they do cassette releases for some bands.
Well, you know, I may be about to blow your mind. Okay.
Yeah.
Because magnetic tape is used in backup, in like huge industrial backups, organization backups. On a daily basis, yeah. Like that, but yeah. Now there is removable hard drives which also use, but point of storage, but yeah, magnetic tape's also an option. Now these are massively high capacity magnetic tapes, so it isn't beyond the realms of possibility that someone produces a successful magnetic or utilizes one of the successful magnetic tape formats and uses those for high definition storage of video. And creates a new video player. It wouldn't be the size of a VHS, although they could obviously manufacture it to be that size. So, I mean, that's an entire, that, you know, that is a possibility. One of the things that VHS was used for, which I meant to mention earlier, there was a device that was launched, a special cable, I think it was, that would connect a computer's disk drive, I'm thinking specifically of a Commodore 64 here, a video player, a video recorder. And you could then copy all of your games to the video recorder and use the video disc, the video cassette as your storage medium for all of your games. And, you know, like a 2 hour cassette would probably hold all of your games with plenty more time to spare.
That's not so mad as it sounds because, you know, it's not much different to a cassette recorder, really.
No. But obviously, because the tape's thicker, I think in width,
and the tape head spins so much faster.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got this extra data storage on a VHS cassette.
You could actually load it really quickly.
Yeah. Another thing, while I'm on this, because I've actually just created a Commodore 64. I haven't created it myself.
You're on form, Mr.
I've just installed a Commodore 64 image on my Raspberry Pi, so I'm about to go and play with some Commodore 64 stuff after we finish.
Paradroid. Best game ever.
Paradroid might be one. Turrican might be another. Yeah. Turrican will be another. Another thing is the Commodore 64, if it wasn't the first, it was one of the first platforms to use CD-ROMs. Thanks to the fact that one of the joystick ports, if you connected a joystick to it and wiggled it, it would input characters. They used that fact and created a special cable. It was Codemasters, created a special cable that could connect to a CD player and release the CD that you could load games from the CD onto the Commodore 64 through this joystick port.
Well, I never. They're clever buggers.
Yeah. Amazing, isn't it? So
I feel enriched and in knowledge does today.
As ever. VHS was the main point of this conversation, of course, ladies and gentlemen. James McLean, Gareth Cavanagh, and myself all shared our recollections of the golden age of home video. We want to hear yours as well. Leave a comment below on Facebook or Twitter or on beyondcasterbridge.com or anywhere else that you find us. And just let us know what you remember, your highs and your lows of the VHS era and any memorable discs? Any memorable cassettes that you want to... Or posters, even, that you want to share. That was a coaxial. Until next time, it's goodbye.